mysteries, not just the Greek mysteries, but many mysteries. They were led through agonies and frightening things and wanderings and so on. And then suddenly, once they get through all that, they come into a beautiful green, verdant field where choric dances are being done and so on. And it's the same in shamanic traditions. The shaman has to descend into the other world, underworld, be totally dismembered, and be regenerated in a new kind of way and overcome and master whatever it is. But, and then when the person does that, then one achieves the peace. It's always, the pattern is always crucifixion first, then resurrection. It's always suffering and search and perplexity and then resolution and finding and so on. That pattern is the pattern of human trial. Now, in the Old Testament, for example, you'll find into the ancient humanity, the ancient Hebrews, you'll find God speaking to the prophets and saying things like, I gave you whiteness of teeth and parchedness of throat. That means I gave you famine and I gave you hunger, and still you did not turn to me. One would say, my God, what kind of a deal is that? God is, you know, in the Old Testament, God was a much lower thing than he became in people's concepts higher, because the concept of God is something that has grown. And so in the Old Testament, God was one of many gods. The great God of Jesus Christ was not the God of the Old Testament. The God of the Old Testament had a name, and he was one of many gods. And he was a god of war and of thunder. And he was a god you thanked who led you on to bash the baby's heads in the street and rape and pillage and all this sort of thing. And it was said that this god would punish his people in order to make them better, like a good father. He would not spare the rod and spoil a child. And these trials, these punishments, this famine and things like this that were brought upon the people were said by the religious leaders of the people to be a divine, not divine punishment, but divine nurture, that God was doing this so people would turn to him and so they would find higher spiritual experience. Well, in the most ancient form of prayer, even the Hebrew word for prayer includes the idea of cutting oneself. The ancient shaman would go through practices of physical harm to one's own body, even cutting the skin in order to expose the blood, and putting oneself through tremendous lamenting and so on in order to get in touch with the divine. It was done through pain. And this is the way humanity has progressed, and the way humanity has become stronger and more evolved is by directly facing certain kinds of pain that were involved in growing and in growth. And it's out of that that a lot of perversion comes and has come in the past. And it is through the experience of pain, psychological pain and other kinds of pain, that human beings actually grow. Now, that doesn't mean that we should all go out and experience all the pain we can because we're going to grow, because people's reaction to pain can be the fast way or the long way. If we have two people, as I said before, they each get their legs blown off in Vietnam, one of them comes to accept it and becomes a constructive person who contributes much to humanity and overcomes his disabilities, the other person remains bitter and dies young of a heart attack and so on. That isn't the end of the other person. The other person just has a longer way to go. My mother Jenny used to stand up and make herself in the form of a cross like this, and she'd say, this is the path humanity has taken for so long. It's the path of crucifixion and suffering. But when one finally is through with this, then she would stand with her legs apart and her hands up, and one becomes a star, and she would stand in the position of five points like this. And it is actually true that we're going through a period now where human growth is possible just as much through joy as it is through suffering. And the strength of the human soul can be strengthened just as well, just as effectively through experiences other than suffering. And the experience of the kinds of adjustments and harmonizations that have to happen in the soul in order for it to expand do not have to be negative. They don't have to be. However, I would qualify that by saying that But when I'm talking about joy and bliss, I'm talking about something that's very profound that I don't want to really go into a lot of details about now, because actually this takes a long time to do. But there are techniques for finding joy and prolonging joy that are techniques that are part of purification, part of soul building. And true joy is experienced very little by human beings. And when they get it, they're scared of it. They don't keep it. They won't hang on to it. And it's like looking the leprechaun in the eye when you catch him. If you can keep him looking him in the eye, then he'll grant all your wishes. And it's the same thing with joy. If you happen to be fortunate enough to be out in the woods and see the sunrise, and suddenly you start to feel something that is really of a very high something that's really beyond words, a great kind of soaring bliss-like feeling, people psychologically dampen that. They will stop that from continuing. They will dampen it, and they will kill it with their minds. And it's a heritage of the ancient humanity and the suffering that humanity's had to go through because the humanity feels, as in general, a human soul feels to allow itself to do that, the human soul is afraid of it because it's afraid it'll take it away and it'll do other kinds with it. The healing, the joy and the healing that are so necessary in the human soul to strengthen it, to bring it together, is not... the human soul has an automatic built-in sensor that will not allow itself to do that. So one has to practice and learn joy practices and bliss practices. And these are things that sounds very bizarre, but it is very difficult to do. I'm not talking about hedonistic practices of any sort. I'm talking about something quite different. And as one begins to sip these nectars and to taste these nectars, one begins to find this. I heard Rinpoche, Sogyal Rinpoche, speaking once about the process he goes through in the morning of drinking his tea and eating, buttering his roll. And that man milks the bliss out of that experience every morning. And if somebody else were to talk about it, if a Christian fundamentalist preacher were to talk about it, a hedonistic pig, you know, or a radical, you know, saying, people are starving and he's enjoying his biscuit, you know, and all this kind of stuff. No, they got it wrong. They got it wrong. Sogyal Rinpoche knows exactly what he's doing. He is doing Dzogchen. And he's doing the bliss practice. And that is something. We have to enjoy everything, even tragedy. There is a way of enjoying. I'm not talking about taking pleasure in. I'm talking about assimilating things in such a way that they become noble. Everything in the life becomes ennobled, and everything is brought into a higher vibration, and everything is sensed as comprehensive and understood, and it's a vibration that is totally apart from irritation. Now, no one that I know, including myself, is certainly capable of being this way all the time, but there are practices that can lead us into this. Now, human trial, human suffering, is soul suffering, psychic suffering, is the way we experience what we have to go through in order to become fixed, in order to become positive and strong. I could compare it perhaps to this. Here's a musician. He wants to become part of this wonderful orchestra. He's accepted into the orchestra. He really is part of the orchestra, but he doesn't get to play until he can play in tune and do things the way he's supposed to. So he has to practice. And he goes through practicing and practicing and practicing until he finally can fit and blend with the orchestra. Now, the process of the practicing the person has to go through is an agon. It's a race. It's something that if the person looks at it and says, oh my God, I have to play etudes and do things like this for 6 years before I'll even be good enough to do this, then the person will look at it be disheartened by it. But if a person takes joy in the playing of the etudes and forgives himself his lapses and goes back and makes it right and so on over and over, and finally the practicing itself becomes the end, and the being able to play with and join the orchestra is something that is a nice byproduct, but it isn't what it's all about. Just as when one plants a garden, one doesn't do the planting of the garden only so that one can taste the fruit. One plants the garden so that one can enjoy planting the garden and go through all the things that are involved in planting the garden and take pleasure in that, and that's complete in itself. And then one goes through watering the garden, all this sort of thing. Then that's the difference between going through what one has to do as a trial and going through what one has to do as a bliss. One, it simply is the attitude one takes towards what one has to do. And one has to do it. There isn't any other choice. One has to do it. It's not that you don't have to practice to get into the orchestra, and it's not that you don't have to plant in order to have a harvest. It's that you must take pleasure in that and find the bliss in that and find the joy in that and the focus in that. And the if one has to study to become something. Go to medical school. One wants to become a doctor. One has a goal. One wants to be a medical doctor. You go to medical school. You get no sleep. You ruin your health becoming a doctor. You ruin your pocketbook. You do all kinds of things. It's very, very difficult to become just a medical doctor, just an MD. It's an agon. It's a trial that one has to go through. But there is a way of going through it. And the people that can go through it and have fun with it can be stimulated by it and can rise to it and go through the challenges and so on, they come out being very, very good doctors. And people that plod their way through it and don't like it and don't enjoy it, they have a very different kind of orientation when they come through. Trial is necessary. It must be there. But trial by fire, parasmos, fiery trial, so to speak, the fire can be warm and gentle, or it can be hot and searing, and all of that depends upon how we approach it. And the final result is the same. We can do it the hard way, we can do it the easy way. Mother Jenny once told me, here's a mountain, she said. Here's the straight path, right up to the top. That's the easy way, but it's hard, because it requires real exertion and focus and will. Here's the hard way, but it looks easy, because you go and meander and do this. One takes a short time, the other one takes a long time. But the easy way is the hard way, and the hard way is the easy way. And when I say the hard way is the easy way, I mean the way that requires the great effort, that we have to make the great effort, is the way that is really the blissful and easy way. Mother Jenny once had a vision of one of her little teachers, an Indian maiden, and she was paddling a canoe upstream against the water. And Mother Jenny asked her, "Why are you paddling this canoe upstream against the water?" And she said, "Because it makes the muscles strong and the face to shine." And that is precisely what it's about. We don't want to avoid challenge. We don't want to do stupid things. I think paddling upstream is a little bit much, but I'm not advocating trying to paddle upstream. But what I'm saying is that we have to take things head on and engage ourselves with them and do it. Not put things off, the easiest way ultimately is the way that requires engagement, and get out and do it right then and there. Mother Jenny, whenever her telephone rang, she said, "That is a cry for help." She didn't say it's somebody trying to interfere, it's evil spirits trying to make it tough or anything like that. That's a cry for help. Wherever she was, in the middle of anything, she would answer her telephone. She was a very old woman. That was her main contact with the outside world. And she, even though she was exhausted, she would answer the telephone in the middle of a lecture, anything. That had priority. That was, to her, her work. When we come into this life, we have, there are different levels. At certain levels of psychic building, at certain levels of soul building, we become very conscious souls. And souls that choose kinds of things that they do in their lives, not for the purpose of building their souls themselves, but for the purpose of augmenting other souls and helping other souls to increase. And the beings who come in life to do that are the beings who are the most engaged with life, and they're what in some tradition are called world servers. They're people who are engaged with life, doing things that help people and that guide people. And they sometimes these people are under a lot of pressure. Sometimes they can have a temper and they can be do this and that. But the sum total, you look at their lives after they've passed out of the body and you see what they've done, what they've accomplished, and compare it to someone else, there's no comparison at all. And then there are beings that come into life with even more consciousness than that, and they finally guide themselves through their intuition into the channel that they're supposed to be, no matter where they are. They finally line up and they get there, and they pursue that, and they do that, and they make that achievement in life. And for each, it's like there are two kinds of things I would distinguish here. There is work. There is the great work that's being done, and there is plenty of workers needed at all kinds of levels. And if one is already in body, let's say Robert or Michael is in body, and a certain kind of work comes up that needs to be done and that is known in higher levels of those who guide the planet. I'm not talking about the highest levels of the universe or anything, but those who are guides and who are telepathic inspirers of us at times and so on. At that level, that job, there's a job, okay? And at that level, you might be asked to do that job. You might be asked or invited telepathically or drawn to do a job like that, whatever that might be, some kind of thing. And when that comes, the job is there. Depending upon how important the job is, there might be more than one person drawn to that. There might be three people, six people, seven people. And the reason for that is if the job is terrifically important, something that has to be done and has to be fulfilled, a role that needs to be fulfilled, then the elders of humanity prepare more than one possibility. They prepare two, three, four, five sometimes. And that, so the situation is the work is there, but the workers are changeable. Who is sensitive enough to find the work and do it? One, the work is there. It's right in front of our very eyes. The worker becomes the one who defines himself as a worker, defines himself as a worker because he does the work, not because he's chosen to do the work in a messianic way. He's one of several people who could do the work and whom is inspired to do the work. On the other hand, if you have a very specific thing, like, for example, the Master Jesus in his lifetime came very specifically into this world with a very specific knowledge that he very quickly awakened in his memory at a very young age, and he knew what he was doing at a very young age, and he went ahead and did it. There wasn't another being that could do that work. It wasn't like, well, here's the work. We need somebody to be, you know, the Christ or something like that. You, who can make it? You know, that kind of thing. No, that's a different thing. That, now you have a different situation where you have a specific soul that is a monadic, highly developed monadic soul that has no need of incarnation, and it is already working at some very much higher level and very high mastery, who has chosen now to come into a body. And then he very quickly begins to remember who he is and what he is and what he does. And he, in his own vernacular, in his own way, and in his own style, brings it together and does the kind of work without any direction. Nobody will do this and I'll do that. Now we know the Master Jesus, according to tradition and legend, was in contact with high beings and he meditated with them and many of them, and he spoke to them, such as the story of the Transfiguration on the mountain where Peter and John are there and they see Jesus talking to Moses and Elijah and so on and these other beings, and they realize he's not working alone. He's got some other help, you know. But basically, it's like this for very advanced souls. And this is something that's important for people today to realize, especially people who are totally out lost in the space of this world and are on their own and don't have teachers guiding them or any kind of thing like this. The story that is told in the Agni Yoga traditions of a general who is fighting on the front for his Maharaja, for his king. And he's a very fine general and a very fine warrior, and he is defeating the enemy and doing things that need to be done and being very successful in this. But he never hears from home. He never gets a message. He never gets a messenger coming telling him what to do. And he has has to do everything by the seat of his pants and on his own hook and with his own brains. And finally, and he wins some, he loses some, but generally he's doing very well. After some time, when there's a lull in the fighting, he feels very badly. He becomes more and more depressed about this, and he finally decides he's going to go all the way back and make the long journey to speak to the king to see why is it that he's getting no direction. He's especially upset because there's another general who's fighting on another front who constantly has messengers going to him. Practically every week there's a messenger coming with directions from the king about what to do. So he goes to see the king, and the king sits with him, and he says, Your Majesty, why is it that you send so many messages to this other general who's doing about as well as I am, but you send none to me and I get no guidance? And the the king said to him, you have no need of guidance. You are a far better general than that other general. The other general needs the guidance, but you don't. I'm very pleased with you. You are my favorite general. And that is something you need to remember when you're in life and you're feeling that you're not getting any visions or any guidance or hearing any voices or nothing is coming to you. You really so much want guidance and this and that. If you are doing what you're doing and working with it, and especially if you're doing spiritual work or work that is augmenting other souls in some kind of way, you don't need messages from home. You know, E.T. don't need to call home. You know, E.T. is doing fine by himself. He's out there doing it because he's part of the symphony. He's playing the music. And from time to time, one is able to withdraw. The Master Jesus withdrew from time to time and went into the wilderness. And he refreshed himself. He redoubled his connections and all this sort of thing. And then he went back out and did it again. And this is how life is for very advanced beings. And there are a lot here. There are a lot of very advanced beings now walking around in two legs in California, in the Bay Area, who haven't fully recapitulated, who haven't fully got the full view and the understanding of who they are and what they are and what they're here to do, but they're looking for it. And I had the privilege of talking to a man from Oregon the other night who is becoming a Templar, who is very, very developed spiritually. And received many initiations from. He's been a Lutheran monk for a couple of years, and he was been very dear, one of the close disciples of Sogo Rinpoche, and who is associating with the temple now because of some special work that he's been moved to do with us, that I'll be talking about later as we get more Templars involved in the work. He has just finally got to this. He's in his middle 30s or late 30s, and just coming to synthesizing all this together. There's so much to synthesize, so much to recapitulate, so many lights to light up again, so much synthesis to finally bring together, and he's at that point. And you remember the people that were here last week? Yes. Okay, and you saw me very specifically uninvite them. Please don't come again, is what basically happened. It was very interesting because I was trying to be nice, and I even went looking for, you know, a little thing about the temple to give, and I couldn't find it, but I found it later. It was there, you know. But the reason that the people came here, and they're very sweet people, and they're at the beginning stages of getting some kind of view with spiritual stuff. They're starting out with Course in Miracles or something, you know, all this kind of stuff. I've forgotten the things they mentioned they were in. And the woman herself especially was very... But the man was very distorted. And the reason that they were here was because we were doing, and I had been doing, this work, this very strong at a distance work with the exorcism with people. And the only way, it was kind of like the ripples that come from throwing a rock in a pond. It was a it was kind of a ripple effect that drew these people here. Then they don't shouldn't be here. This isn't for them, and this isn't their level of working, nor is it their affinity at this point. They have other places to be and other groups to work with and so on. But it brought them here for that one night. It was an interesting demonstration, I think, of if we had sat with them in a group and tried to do group meditation, it would have been like mixing tomato soup and a milkshake or something. You know, it wouldn't have worked. It would have been an unworkable kind of thing. And that's why groups that have to work together, there has to be very specific rays that the people qualify, and that there has to be very there has to be all the dimensions of something in a group, but not all the dimensions of psychic life and psychic building. There has to be and to work with this temple, there has to be a certain, I think the way we express it is people who are mature and workers, spiritual workers who are doing things on a certain level and all this kind of stuff. I don't know, but I've tried to say that in the material. But they're coming in. Was very wonderful to me because they had learned about it at Heart Dance, and I'm real sure I won't put that in Heart Dance. The only place I'll put this is in Gnosis from now on, I think. It's the only place I'm going to put any kind of notice, I think, because of that. It's not that I want just to bring in people who are just intellectuals or Gnostics or something like that, but that's about the only place that I can put something in that I think will, that everyone who's called on that has been really just the right vibration. So that's where I'm going to keep the information out there. But the reason I mention this business is that when we do soul building and soul work and so on, the group is very important. And the we gain something each week from the Eucharist, from this Grail work. That is something that comes into us, that becomes part of us. And we need that extra. We need that extra help and that extra energy that comes from working this thing, which is like the extra vitamin nurture we need. We also need the whatever meditation practices, whatever else we do that is building and bringing in that energy. And The liturgy itself brings the benedictions and blessings and nectars and fragrances, and it sends them out into the world, and the right group, the right bringing together, the right group has this tremendous power for helping us to achieve these 540 calories per gram of water per phase change, and the preparations for purity and the purity practices do this as well. Now I have. Robert, I've given you this soap, which I call temple soap, and I've told you what's in it. This is the way it should be used.
It has peppermint.
It has equal parts of peppermint, and it has... the opposite of rosemary. Lavender. Thank you. And eucalyptus, that all act on certain kinds of subtle levels, and then added to it is a very small amount of wormwood. These all act on all the subtle bodies to clear, cleanse, purify, and put into a flux around the aura, so that the aura itself can be cleaned and cleansed, and so that one can relieve oneself of a lot of burden on the subtle level. What the way to do it is, as soon as you can, you need to take two shower. So do you have a shower? Okay, two showers with this. Use half material the first time. Place it on the crown of the head. You lather all the way down your body like that. You don't leave it on a long time. Then you wash it all off. You know, we shower it all off. And you will notice the slight bitter taste of the worm, but don't worry about it. It's not harmful or anything, but it will be in your aura. Then you sit down and you do whatever meditation practices you do that involve visualizing the aura as completely white, as a complete white light, right afterwards. However you can sit and do that visualization. I do it with sound. Tess and I do it with sound, but you know, however you would do that. And the time to do it is as soon as possible, and the next time to do it is on the night of Friday the 20th, right before the full moon, to do the shower again, either that morning or that evening, whenever, that sometime that day.
So it might be at 8 o'clock on Friday?
Yeah, it could be in the evening, it could be in the morning, but just so you do that practice and also visualizing the aura, and then at the time of the full moon, at the time of the exact full moon, to use the visualization of the master, the Antakarana building, the one I gave you, remember? A very important thing to do, and that will begin and kick off the period of preparation for the receiving of the ordination.
When is the exact time of the full moon?
It's about 2 a.m. on Friday night going into Saturday morning. I'll have that information next week. I've forgotten exactly what it is. It's about that time.
So I should set my alarm.
Oh yeah, and about 10 or 15 minutes beforehand. And that's a very important time to do that visualization.
I haven't done that yet. So
yeah, and you'll be doing that that night too.